Good to be with you this evening. If you would turn in your Bibles to Acts chapter 17, we'll be spending some time there. For some of you, this will be a little bit of a rerun, perhaps. We spent a little bit of time looking at this chapter last Wednesday night in our class and thinking about Paul's lesson at the Areopagus, which is what we're going to be thinking about tonight. More and more, I think that not only the content of our teaching needs to be biblical, and certainly we would all agree on that, but also the means we use to convey that content needs to be biblical. And I think we have an exemplary pattern set forth here by the Apostle Paul in terms of reaching out with the gospel to a group of people who have a fundamentally different view of the world than Paul has. And that there's not, in reality, there's not one view of the world represented here, but there are a host of different views represented. Paul, as we will see, was troubled by the idolatry that he saw in the city of Athens. His spirit was provoked within him as he was observing a city full of idols, we're told in Acts 17, 16. And when he goes up to the Areopagus, he is in the company not only of pluralistic pagans, but also of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. And all three of these groups, the sort of run-of-the-mill pagans and the Stoics and the Epicureans, all have a very different view of the world. They all approach things from a very different standpoint. Obviously, the idolaters were very pluralistic in their way of looking at the world, and they admitted the possibility of many gods, and they weren't very exclusive in their views. The Romans would, and Greeks would often take in gods from other cultures. The philosophers that were there that day had a little bit different view of the world. The Epicureans believed that the world, the universe, was material and eternal. Epicurus believed in the gods. However, much like later deists, Epicurus believed that the gods were separate from the world and lived a tranquil life disconnected from the physical universe. And so they weren't really involved. There's no point in praying. There's no point in offering sacrifices or worshiping because they're not going to do anything. They are separated from the world and all that is in it. And so the Epicureans were often referred to as atheists because they discounted all of the worship that went on and did not believe the gods had any involvement in the world. The Stoics, on the other hand, had a very different view. They believed that all things are material. But they had a different view than the Epicureans. Each material thing in their mind existed in three ways. If we were to look at a tree, they would say the tree has three material existences. There is the word tree, which in their view is a material thing. There is the idea of a tree, which is also, in their view, a material thing. And then there is the tree itself. And there are two kinds of matter in the world. There is the grosser sort of matter, stuff like this. And then there is the pneuma, the spirit, the logos, the other kind of matter that they would have called the finer matter. And in their view, God is sort of diffused throughout the world. They were pantheists, and so God was sort of in everything. But he was not separate from the world. He is not other than the material world. He is just infused through the material world. And yes, you should seek God in all things. But their view, obviously, very, very different. When they said God, they meant something completely different than Paul meant. Or than the Epicureans meant. Or than the idolaters meant. They all have different definitions. And so Paul's situation really is very much like our own situation, where we're dealing with people who approach the world from all kinds of different standpoints. We meet people every day who are materialists, atheists, and we meet people who are postmodernists, and we meet people who have bought into Eastern beliefs and different kinds of worldviews. And a lot of times what we'll do is we'll try and speak the gospel to people like that, and they just sort of summarily dismiss it as irrelevant. And we wonder at that. But what we're running up against is the fact that they don't view the world the same way as we do. And so how do you reach somebody like that? Well, Acts 17 is a textbook in how to reach somebody with the gospel who doesn't see the world the way you do. And so we want to look at what Paul does here. In Acts 17:22, beginning, it says, "So Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, 'Men of Athens, I observe that you are very religious in all respects. For while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I also found an altar with the inscription to an unknown God. Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you.'" Now, we've already noted in Acts 17:16 that Paul is very disturbed by their idolatry. He is no fan of what is going on religiously in Athens. In fact, he is shocked by what he sees. And yet, Paul found a way to build a bridge. Now, if some of you have the King James Version, or are using the King James Version, the word translated religious, you may have superstitious. And that word indeed is somewhat ambiguous. It could be, in a good context, it had a good connotation, and in a bad context, it had a bad connotation. It could mean either one. And so the question is, how is Paul using it? Paul is certainly not endorsing what he sees. That's not the point. But I do think he is building a bridge. He has looked around and he has observed, and there is some documentation of this fact, that there were idols or there were altars to unknown gods that the Athenians had set up for whatever reason. And Paul is not suggesting, when he appeals to that, that he thinks the Athenians are in some way aware of the true God. What he's doing is he's grabbing hold of the acknowledgement, the implicit acknowledgement that there was a God or gods in their thinking out there that they didn't know. And he said, well, that's right. There is a God that you don't know. And he's thankful that they're so interested in seeking God, evidenced by all of these altars. And he says, I want to talk to you about this God you don't know. And the acknowledgement of their very ignorance gives him an opportunity to speak to that. Now, there's a really important lesson here, and I will give credit to the class the other night in raising some of these points that I'm going to make. But there's an important lesson here for us. Paul does this all the time in his sermons. He makes a connection with his audience, and it really doesn't matter who he's talking to. In Acts chapter 14, in verse 15, when he is addressing a group of pagans in Lystra, who are trying to worship him as a god, as well as his traveling companion. He says, men, why are you doing these things? We are also men of the same nature as you. And so Paul builds a bridge. He says, we're just like you are. And what I want to talk to you about is this God. Now, that didn't go so well. But he does seek to establish some common ground upon which he can build. Later, in Acts 22 and verse 3, when he addresses an angry mob that wants to kill him in Jerusalem, he does the very same thing. This is a Jewish angry mob this time. And so he gets up, and the first thing he does, although Paul is conversant in Greek, because he's just addressed in the context, he has just addressed the commander in Greek. When he turns to his Jewish audience, he addresses them in Hebrew, because that is their preferred language. And he says to them in Hebrew, I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city, that is in Jerusalem, educated under Gamaliel, one of the prominent rabbis of the day, strictly according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God just as you all are today. And Paul, again, he builds a bridge. And he says, here's something that we have in common. And Paul goes on to explain that everything he's done from that moment, even to this moment, has been because of his zeal for the Lord. Paul builds a bridge. He finds some common ground with his audience. And that is a lesson that we need to learn. It doesn't mean we have to endorse what is wrong. Clearly, we don't want to do that, because we're trying to get them from where they are to where they need to be. And so we don't want to endorse where they are in a bad sense. But let me suggest something else. Nobody's wrong about everything. Nobody's that good. Nobody is skilled enough to be wrong about everything. Everybody has some idea that is either right or closely approximates what is right. And those points of contact are opportunities for us to connect. And we want to connect at points that provide an opportunity to speak the gospel into that situation. And this particularly provided Paul with an opportunity, because they're admitting there's a God they don't know. And Paul said, well, this is great. This acknowledgement that there's a God that you don't know, or in their view, perhaps gods that they did not know. Paul said, I want to talk to you about this God that you don't know. And so that was a place where Paul could build a bridge and reach out to them at a level that they would understand and appreciate. And that's the foundation of this sermon, this bridge that he builds. And so he begins to talk to them about God, the Creator. And he talks about this fundamental relationship. And he says to them, in verse 24, the God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in a temple made with hands, nor is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. And so he first establishes that God has made the world. And this would have been difficult for them to grasp, even as it is difficult for people today. The Epicureans believed the physical universe was eternal. They didn't believe in even the idea of creation. And the Stoics were pantheists. That is, they believed that God is part of the creation. But Paul is preaching a God who is outside of creation, who transcends the created world and made it himself. And so he's seeking to rewrite their understanding of the world that they live in. He is seeking to rewrite their worldview in biblical terms. And several things necessarily follow from this idea that God made the world. He says in Acts 17:24 that because God made the world, he is Lord of heaven and earth. Now, this is absolutely critical. Very often, In today's world, if you're engaging somebody who is sort of postmodernist and you talk to them, you go to them and you tell them the story of Jesus, very likely what they will say in response to the story of Jesus is they will say, well, that is a very nice story. And I'm really thankful that you derive meaning and purpose from that story. I'm glad for you. But that's not my thing. I derive meaning and purpose from other things. And you have your story, and I have my story. And here's a coexist bumper sticker for your car. Thank you for your time. And they go on their way. And we scratch our heads a little bit. The response to that is exactly what Paul did. It is to say, now, hold on a minute. If it is true that there is a God, and that this God made the world, then we all belong to Him and we're accountable to Him. And we've got to give an answer to Him. And so we can't just dismiss that. And there are all kinds of people crying out today, we've got to make the gospel relevant. Listen, there's nothing more relevant than the idea that God made the world. That is the most relevant concept there possibly could be. Because if God made the world, He is Lord of heaven and earth. And if He is Lord of heaven and earth, then we're accountable to Him. And the fact that there is an eternal, transcendent, just God who is going to judge the world in righteousness, and there are going to be eternal consequences to that, that's a pretty relevant thought, given the fact that it affects all eternity. And so the necessary implications of the idea that God made the world make Paul relevant. He goes on to say that if there is a God who made the world and He is sovereign over it, He doesn't dwell in temples made with hands. And of course, that is consistent with the kind of thing that Solomon said in 1 Kings 8:27, or that Stephen quoted actually from Isaiah in Acts 7:48-50. And the more philosophically minded Greeks would have agreed. They thought that a lot of what passed for idol worship in their day and time was ridiculous. That no sound understanding of God could possibly be reduced to such a crass relationship where you're bartering with the gods for their goodwill. But Paul affirms that God does not dwell in temples made with hands. Nor is He served by human hands as though He needs anything. If God made the universe, then He doesn't need anything from us. There's nothing we can bring to the table that's going to recommend us to God. There's nothing we can give to God that He needs from us. And of course, again, this is perfectly consistent with what has been revealed in the Old Testament in places like Psalm 50, where God says, if I were hungry, I would not tell you the cattle on a thousand hills are mine. I mean, flip those two and that you get the order right, but that the point is the same. God doesn't need anything from us. But that ran contrary to the more unsophisticated concepts of idolatry. Although some of the Greek philosophers had said things like this. The flip side of this is He Himself gives to all people life and breath in all things. The reality is we need God. And again, this establishes responsibility. Not only, Paul is not simply saying that God started up the universe, He created everything. But Paul is saying something very much more significant than that. What he is saying is that God is constantly sustaining the universe. And not only our origins derive from God, but our very being derives from God. We are sustained by Him moment by moment. Again, that makes this relevant. If the God we're answerable to is sustaining our every breath, the every beat of our heart, we need to think about that. And that is, in fact, what Paul is asserting. Well, why? Why has God done this? What is the purpose of all this? Well, that's exactly where Paul goes in Acts 17, 26 and 27. He made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, that they would seek God, if perhaps they might grope for Him and find Him, though He is not far from each one of us. Now, this is really the heart of Paul's message. Notice, again, he's doing some bridge building, even as he is beginning to challenge them in a very practical way. He says that God made every nation, every people of mankind to live on the face of the earth. And they all came from one man. And so, Paul, and this is somewhat, it's not unbiblical, certainly. It's eminently biblical, but it's a little bit un-Jewish, if you get my meaning, to kind of lump everybody together. But that's precisely what Paul does. He says, you know, we may come from different nations, different places, have different approaches. But the reality is, the same God made every one of us. We have a common descent. We're all in the same boat. And in fact, though we do come from various nations, all of these nations are ruled over by God. He has determined their boundaries. He has determined their times, that is, which nation will be dominant, and which nation will be submissive, and set boundaries for them. And everything He's done, all of His operation in history, has been toward one end, that man might seek God. That is our purpose. That's everybody's purpose. That's not the purpose of the Jews. It's not the purpose of the Greeks. It's the purpose of every man under heaven, is to seek God. But then Paul introduces a measure of doubt about, in the seeking, whether or not they're going to do any finding. He says, if perhaps they might grope for Him. And the perhaps is a very doubtful perhaps. We're not doing a very good job. And indeed, all of the idols in the city of Athens were a towering testimony to the fact that man was not doing a very good job of finding God. They might be seeking God, but they're not finding Him. And though he has not used the term, he is introducing here the idea of sin. That man has failed in his quest to seek God. But the failure is not on God's side, because God is close to each one of us. He is there, and he has left evidence that he might in fact be found, even though he has not been found. God wants to be known. He wants his creatures to discover Him. But they have not. Paul now presses that home as he begins to convict them about this failure. When he says in verses 28 and 29, "For in Him we live and move and exist, as some of your own poets have said, for we also are His children. Being then the children of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image to be formed by the art and thought of man." Paul once again plugs into the culture, into the Greek thinking. When he says, in Him we live and move and exist, this was a very standard Greek way of talking about the existence of man. Now understand that, and I think standard in Greek thought, but perhaps would have been language that the Stoics would have used, among others, but certainly they would have used it. They would have used this in a very pantheistic way. That, you know, God is sort of all around us. And so we're moving through God and part of God ourselves. Now, Paul has transformed that understanding. He uses language they recognize, but he's transformed the meaning of all the terms because God is not the God that is all through creation. God is the God who is the Creator. He is separate from His creation. He is above His creation. He is sovereign over His creation, but He is near to His creatures. And He is sustaining them. And that sustaining power ought to speak to His creatures about who He is. And then he goes on to quote one of their poets when he says that we are His children. Now, the quotation is probably from Aretas. And Aretas of Soli had written or actually taken a work about astronomy, which was a sort of an essential study in the Greek world because they used astronomy to keep track of time and days and seasons. And they used astronomy to navigate. And so you just needed to learn astronomy if you were going to know what time it was or where you were going. And so everybody learned. Aretas took this work on astronomy and he put it in verse. So it was much easier to memorize. But Aretas was of a Stoic bent, and so he infused this very common Greek work with a lot of Stoic ideas, this being one of them. That we are His children. And everybody read Aretas. It was among the first works to be translated when others encountered Greek thinking. And so you had Homer and you had Aretas, and those were the best sellers in the Greek world. And so Paul is plugging into something that would have been commonly known, commonly learned among all Greek people. And what he is saying here, when he says we also are His children, again, he's taking an idea of theirs and he's transforming it. And he's saying that we learn something about who God is by looking at what He has created. And fundamentally, what He's created in His own image. And the idea is that if you have a cause and an effect, we being the effect, God being the cause, the attributes of the effect must in some sense be in the cause. I mean, that's necessary. You can't have a cause that is insufficient to generate the effect. That's not a good. So, for instance, if I apply 1 pound of force to this pulpit and it flies all the way across the room, the 1 pound of force I applied was not the cause of it flying all the way across the room. You've got to find another cause because that's not a sufficient. I don't have the strength to chunk it all the way across the room. The cause is insufficient for the effect. So if you have an effect that has reason and purpose and morality and love and mercy and justice and a sense of those things, then those things have to be exist in the cause if they exist in the effect. So we look at human nature and we can discern some things about the Creator by looking at the creature. Now, we can't discern everything about the Creator by looking at the creature. We mustn't make God in our image. But we can recognize something of His image in us. And it seems to me that Paul is arguing along those lines, and I think we should argue along those lines. I think that's still a good argument. Because I think a lot of the explanations of where we came from fail to recognize that very basic truth that you have to have an adequate cause for an effect. It's just a simple, logical conclusion. And Paul says we ought to be able to look at ourselves and know that God is not some statue in some shack down the corner. That's not an adequate representation of who God is. That's not even an adequate representation of who we are. That's crazy. And so we have missed God. And make no mistake, Paul is convicting them of sin. They had sought God the wrong way, and so doing, they had not found Him, and they had misrepresented Him terribly. They had indeed blasphemed in their attempt to find God. They had blasphemed. And I will tell you, That we must show our own culture where they have gone wrong if the cross is going to have any meaning. You cannot present a solution without getting some agreement about what the problem is. It's just no good. And so then Paul says to them, finally, and in conclusion, therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to men that all people everywhere should repent, because He has fixed a day in which He will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom He has appointed, having furnished proof to all men by raising him from the dead. And this idea that God has been merciful in overlooking such ignorance is, again, something that comes up again and again. In Acts chapter 14 and verse 16, Paul said something very similar. In the generations gone by, He permitted all the nations to go their own ways. In Romans 3:25, speaking with regard to the propitiation of Christ, Paul said this was to demonstrate His righteousness, because in the forbearance of God, He passed over the sins previously committed. All of this speaks to God's forbearance. But that time is over. And now it's time to repent, and they have become responsible because the unknown God has been made known. And Paul has made this God known to them. And so he tells them that God has fixed a day for judgment, and He has appointed a man to carry out that judgment, and He has furnished proof by raising that man from the dead, Jesus Christ. He doesn't spend a lot of time talking about sacrifice and talking about salvation, because they're not going to understand that. He doesn't have a group of Jews here. But He talks to them about judgment and how that they need to turn and seek God. And finally, we read that when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some began to sneer. But others said, "We shall hear you again concerning this." So Paul went out of their midst, but some men joined him and believed, among whom also were Dionysius the Areopagite and a woman named Damaris and others with them. And so Paul doesn't get a great response. And we need to appreciate the difficulty and the challenge of rewriting somebody's worldview. That's not an easy thing to do. You sit down with somebody and tell them what you're going to do. Say, "Excuse me, I'd like for us to sit down. And what I want to do is I think the whole way you see the world is wrong, and so I want to change all that." Okay, well, that is an ambitious endeavor. But the fact is, that's exactly what Paul was doing. He doesn't announce his intention to do that, but that's exactly what he's doing. He is rewriting their view of the world, or attempting to rewrite their view of the world, along biblical lines. But at the same time, he is seeking to rewrite their worldview along biblical lines. He is doing it in terms they understand. And that's key. You compare this sermon to Acts chapter 2, or if we're going to take another Pauline sermon, Acts chapter 13, where in those passages, Paul quotes a lot of Old Testament. Paul says a lot of Old Testament things here, but he doesn't quote the passages. In fact, what he quotes is a Greek poet. He's saying Old Testament things in ways that they can understand. He's using the Old Testament scriptures. There's no doubt about that, but he's using it in ways that they will be able to connect to and they will be able to understand. It is a thoroughly biblical approach, but it is tuned to their need to make a connection with them in terms that they can understand and appreciate. And that's what we need to do today. He doesn't spend a lot of time talking about sacrifices, and he doesn't spend a lot of time talking in terms of redemption or salvation. The Jews had been prepared for 2,000 years to hear those sermons. This crowd is not ready for that. Doesn't mean it's less true for them. Doesn't mean it's not relevant to them. They're just not there yet. And so Paul approaches them in a way that they can understand. And that's what we need to do. The gospel doesn't change. He preaches Jesus Christ and the resurrection from the dead. And we need to, we've got to get to that. That's the ultimate goal. We're trying to get people to the story of Jesus Christ. But until they agree on the problem, the solution is going to have no meaning. None whatsoever. And we live in a world where people don't agree on the problem. They've got all kinds of different ideas about what our problem is, or even what our reality is. And so we've got to come to some common ground about what reality means and what the central problem of man is. And then we can speak the gospel. But if we go straight to the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, a lot of people are not going to hear that because they're not ready to hear that. There's a reason that comes toward the end of the Bible. God spent a lot of time, and I mean a lot of time, getting people ready to hear that. If we just go back to Abraham and start there, 2,000 years getting people ready for the gospel. So it may take more than one Bible study to get people who have no idea about what God has been doing for the 2,000 years leading up to the time of Christ. It may take a little time to get them ready to hear that. But that's exactly what we need to do. We need to prepare their minds for the gospel in the same way that God prepared the minds of His people and prepared our minds, indeed. And so it's going to take some work. But Paul cared enough about these people and was disturbed enough about their spiritual situation to invest himself in doing that. And so I would challenge each and every one of us to have that same love for souls and to invest ourselves in understanding the culture we live in well enough to be able to reach out to them and speak to them in terms they can understand about the nature of the world we live in, that we are created by a God who is sovereign. And He has worked through all history to save us through Jesus Christ. And I think if we will use biblical truths in biblical ways, we will reach hearts. Not all hearts. Not all hearts are willing to be reached. But we will reach some. And so I commend these things to your thinking. I thank you for your kind attention and your patience. If you're not a Christian, then know that we are all creatures of God and we must all stand before Him on the day of judgment and give an account. And so we have a basic choice before us. We can stand before God on our own merits, which is not going to end well. Or we can stand before God and appeal to the mercy and grace of God that is offered through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, which is the only way that we really can stand before God. And so I would ask you this evening, how will you stand before God? Will you stand before God alone and in your sin? Or will you stand before God trusting in the sacrifice of Jesus Christ? If you would stand before God trusting in the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, then come to God through Jesus, believing in Him, repenting of your sins, and being baptized. If you're a Christian and you need the prayers of the saints, you need our help in some kind of way, come now as we stand and as we sing.